1, 2, 3. On Sunday, February 18th at 11 p.m., Suge in My Bowl presents drummer, composer, band leader, and son of jazz pianist Thelonious Monk, T.S. Monk. Join us as we discuss some parts of T.S. Monk's career and the direction that he's taken the memory of his father. That's Sunday, February 18th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving. So bad. I feel so funny. I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on. Save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is drummer, composer, band leader, and son of pianist Thelonious Monk, T.S. Monk. You can show your financial support by going to give2WBAI.org. That's give2WBAI.org. Or you can call us at 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or you can text us to the number 41444 and text WBAI. You can text us to the number 41444 and text WBAI. Stay tuned. Suge in My Bowl starting now.
I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar in my bowl.
One, two, three. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with
T.S. Monk.
T.S. Monk, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I am grateful for your time that you're going to spend with us. First, I have to thank Denise Pruitt for making this happen. I met her at the Winter Jazz Festival.
Yeah. She told me she met you there. Good for him.
Yeah, indeed. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I'm going to start with, well, you have a date coming up. You and the sextet.
Yeah. It's in Morristown, New Jersey, on the 22nd, and it's going to be the sextet. It's sort of an evening of me and my dad, maybe a tune or two of mine and some tunes of his and a couple of other things to keep things interesting. And I'm looking forward to it. You know, I always have a good time, especially here in Jersey. I'm from New York for the first 45 years of my life, but the last 20 have been in Jersey, so I'm kind of a Jersey boy these days. I enjoy playing out here. The people actually, there's a remarkably vibrant jazz community here in Jersey, so which was a surprise to me coming from Manhattan. So I look forward to the gig. I got a great sextet, and I've got an interesting young lady by the name of April May, who is going to be performing with me. I like singers. I'm not one of them cats that is afraid the singer's going to take up too much oxygen, you know. I mean, no, people like singers, but I look at the history of the music and I say, well, Count Basie didn't have a problem with Ella or Frank Sinatra, and Norman Conners didn't have a problem with Phyllis Hyman,
right.
And Cannonball Adderley didn't have a problem with Nancy Wilson.
Right.
So why should I have a problem? Because it seemed to work out very well for all of those guys. So I'm looking forward to the gig. It should be fun.
It is at the
Dickford Theater in Morristown. And it's on Thursday, the 22nd of the month.
Right, from 7:30 to 8:30. They actually have a start and end time here for your set.
Yeah, well, that's always theoretical start time, as far as I'm concerned, from the venue's point of view, and a theoretical end time for me.
Okay.
An hour later, you know, who knows? It will be a good time. Anybody that comes will certainly get their money's worth and have a great time, no matter how much time I spend on the bands. It's the one area of my life I'm very confident that's in performing. It should be a lot of fun.
And Denise Pruitt had shared that April May Webb, the songs that she will be singing are Round Midnight and In Walk Bud.
Yeah, probably something that, you know, she is part of a very interesting duo that she has with my trumpet player, whose name is Randall Haywood. They call their little duo SOAR, S-O-A-R. They've been doing a bunch of things with me. I sort of think of them as sort of the group within the group, you know. So they'll probably perform something with just the duo, just the two of them.
Oh,
It's a really interesting sound, and I'm old school. I like to push people. If I have an opportunity where I can showcase somebody who's new and fresh, it's just no skin off my back. Maybe because my name is Monk, that anesthetizes me on a certain level, but not really. I just think that it's an important part of jazz is pushing the next generation. Everyone I know, everyone that you know and love, whether you're talking about Clifford Brown or Miles Davis or John Coltrane or my father, every one of them can, if you trace their history, there's some ties back to someone that preceded them that gave them a shot. For my father, it was Coleman Hawkins. For Miles Davis, it was the Charlie Parker Big Band. For Charlie Parker, it was the Jimmy Lunsford Big Band.
Right.
Of course, for John Coltrane, it was my father. The list goes on and on. It's a good thing. And it's just essentially staying in the tradition of how the music has always moved from generation to generation.
And I just want to let the listeners know, to find out more about this performance at the Bickford Theater, it's actually part of the Morris Museum. So you can go to themorrismuseum.org. MORRIS museum.org.
Okay.
We have more business to mention. There's a recording that you're featured on. It's Valente Moya Meets Monk.
Oh, right.
On HKM Records.
Yeah.
How did that come about? It's actually, it has a Jazz Manouche connection. Am I pronouncing that
correctly?
Yeah.
It's really, Valentino is a wonderful guitarist, and he's out of what we on this side of the ocean would call the gypsy tradition in Spain. Of course, let me be clear for those listeners who don't know. Those folks in Europe who are referred to as gypsies,
they don't like it.
Absolutely hate the term gypsy.
That's right.
you know, so I want to be clear on that one, because I would never say that to him. But just for the sake of identification, you know, and familiarity, that's the tradition he's from, which is essentially the folk music.
Right.
Thelonious music has transcended American jazz, not only in terms of other artists around the world who perform jazz. Frankly, his music has transcended jazz in that many, many great artists who are not of the jazz genre have recorded his music for many, many reasons. And Valentino's no different. I have a sub-publisher in the Netherlands that came up with the idea to interface me with an artist like Valentino. I did a record a year earlier in Belgium with a Belgian accordion.
Yes, I was going to mention that one, actually.
Thank you.
Yeah, and his name was Ronnie Verbiest.
Yes.
V-E-R-B-I-E-S-T. That was a lot of fun, too. So I'm actually having a lot of fun at this particular juncture in Thelonious Legacy, given that this year is his centennial.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a lot of fun. I'm very happy for him because Thelonious is a classic example of a guy you could say, oh, he was right and they were wrong. Because the fact of the matter is that although his music and as a performer, he was summarily panned as a new artist by the critics. Here we are in the year 2018, and Thelonious is now the number two most recorded jazz composer, second only to Duke Ellington, and his composition, Round Midnight, is the most recorded composition in the history of jazz. So he's done rather well for a guy that they said was crazy, and his music made no sense. I say all the time, Daddy, you nailed them. You nailed all those critics. I can't even find one that will say, oh, I didn't like Thelonious Monk. You know, everybody says, oh, you say Monk. Oh, Thelonious Monk. Oh, I love him. I love him. I love him. In fact, Thelonious, probably his most famous live engagement was a 9-month stint that he spent at the Five Spot Cafe in New York City with John Coltrane and Johnny Griffin and Roy Haynes and people like that. And I had so many people tell me that, oh, I saw your father at the Five Spot. I say to myself, if everybody who has told me that they saw my father at the Five Spot actually saw my father at the Five Spot, he'd have been a millionaire from that one gig alone. You know, that's a tribute to him,
yeah,
and a tribute to his impact, because it just goes to the issue of how badly so many people who didn't see him would have liked to have seen him.
Right. Well, the Five Spot also probably would have violated the fire code as well.
Absolutely. I was there as a kid, and I can tell you, I would think it held maybe 70 people
right,
on any given night, you know, but it's all okay.
Yeah.
You know, my mother once told me that as far as the people who didn't like Thelonious in the beginning, who loved him later on, you have to allow people time to change. And innovators like a Thelonious Monk, whether it's Monk in music or Einstein in science, it takes people a minute to catch on when you're that far ahead of the curve.
Right. I want to talk about your father more, but I actually want to talk about you even more because, and that's why I mentioned those two recordings, Valenti Moya meets Monk and Verbiest, or Verbiest.
Yes, Verbiest.
Verbiest meets Monk, father and son, because you're the drummer on those recordings.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, you're a drummer. Let's talk about you and your drumming for a little bit.
Sure.
Now, I understand that Max Roach was your instructor and Art Blakey gave you some stick. How did that work?
No, actually, when I was 4 or 5, Max Roach gave me some stick.
Okay.
Art Blakey gave me some drums.
Right.
But when I told my father, I was late. I didn't decide that this is something that I wanted to do until I was 15 years old. And when I told my father that I wanted to play the drums, seriously, he called Art Blakey, and that's when Art Blakey gave me some drums.
That you sold.
But then, yeah, it's terrible, but honesty is the best policy. And, you know, once I tell people that Art Blakey gave me a set of drums, you know, if I tell that to any jazz drummer, they're going to say, well, where are the drums?
Right.
And I have to say, no, you don't understand. You just don't understand what it's like to be 18 years old and all of a sudden all these new rock and roll drums come out made out of fiberglass and looking all fabulous. And I just got dazzled. And also, for me, people like Art Blakey and John Coltrane and Miles Davis, they were just daddy's friends. I didn't think of them as giants for the ages. They were just daddy's friends. So I want some new drums. So I traded in the drums Art gave me. Of course, it sounds very insane today, but as a 17, 18-year-old, it made absolute sense.
Of course.
But the more interesting thing was sending me to Max Roach's house, because he actually called Art Blakey and Max Roach on the same day, right, within 2 or 3 minutes of each other. And, of course, he called Art, and he said, you know, hey, Art, my nickname is Toot, T-O-T, so I remember saying, hey, Art, look, Toot needs some drums. And, you know, they shot the bull a little bit, but I got some drums a few days later.
Wow.
But when he hung up from the phone from Art Blakey, he immediately, now you have to understand that Thelonious didn't make phone calls. I made phone calls, my mother made phone calls for him, my sister made phone calls, but he didn't make any phone calls for himself, really, at this point. So I thought it was incredible that Dad was now making not only one, but two phone calls in a row. And the second phone call, I swear, couldn't have been more than 40 seconds. I remember my father dialing the number. He puts the phone to his ear. He says, "Hey, Max, look, Toot wants to play the drums, and you're the greatest drummer in the world, so I'm sending him to your house. Click." And told me to go to Max Roach's house. And so I did. So that's a marvelous, marvelous moment in my life, that particular day, because I don't know if I'd be here today as a world-class drummer who's had hits and awards and those kind of things had that not happened that day. It was very special. And even though I didn't know how important Art Blakey and Max Roach were in the real big picture of modern music, what I did know was that these are my dad's friends, and they all seem to be really, really serious. So I'm going to have to be really, really serious.
Great.
And it was a great, great starting point for me.
I've heard you mention during a workshop with musicians, you were talking about drummers in particular and how they, and they do, tune their drums differently in order to achieve their personal sound, their style.
Absolutely.
You know? Now, when I hear you play, though, no matter whether it's an up-tempo or ballad, and I hope you don't mind my saying so, I hear it as a gentle style or soft. Even if you're swinging hard, you have a light touch. Now, is that my imagination or is that something that you do occasionally?
I don't know if it's necessarily light, but I would like to think of it as rather organized. And when I listen to a lot of drummers, and I'm not just talking about jazz drummers, but drummers in general, I find a lot of guys lack the dynamic grammar that's necessary. I mean, nobody played harder than Elvin Jones.
Yes.
But Elvin was so organized that he never got in the way. It always complemented what was happening with Coltrane, what was happening with McCoy Tyner, what was happening in that quartet.
Mm-hmm.
He could rumble like thunder.
Right.
But one can only feel the thunder if you feel the calm.
Mm.
It's like you don't know when the road is really rough until you hit a smooth patch.
Right.
And then you hit another rough patch and then you say, oh yeah, this road is rough and it's smooth. That even the chaos of a road sometimes can be organized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what I like to look through in my playing that you might interpret as a little softer. I think it's just, you know, I'm a drummer. See,
right.
And this is what a lot of guys do not understand. And that's why they can't be drummers, band leaders. When I'm the drummer, so I don't care how big my name is on the marquee. If a saxophone player is standing in front of me playing a solo, my job at the drummer is to be behind him,
right.
To be under him,
right.
To support him. It's not to bash and crash my way and let everybody in the audience know how many chops I got and how loud I can play. The key, and I tell this to younger drummers all the time that aspire to be an actual drummer band leader, I say, you got to get the best musicians that you can possibly get, and they get the best music you can possibly get, and then forget about the drum solos all day and night, because nobody understands drum solos.
Hmm.
I'm sorry. Just other drummers. Just the other drummers.
And I've heard you say that, too. But by understand, what do you mean? They don't get it? They don't groove with it? What?
People understand 1, 2, 3, 4. People do not understand polyrhythm. They don't get it. That's why if you listen, particularly today, if you listen to modern current hip-hop or R&B, you'll find that the beat is basically on 2 and 4.
Very simple.
And that's what everybody gets.
That's not fair.
The only drum solo, think about this, there's only one drum solo in the history of American music that the general public knows. And that is a stupid four-measure solo that's played on a tune from the 1950s by a group called The Ventures, and it's called Wipeout. And everybody knows Wipeout. But Wipeout is basically a 2 and 4 solo.
Mm.
So if you want to be the drummer band leader, then you have to do like Max Roach, who played great solos.
Right.
But Max Roach is really famous for backing Charlie Parker, for the Oom Boom Orchestra, for the Uptown Strings, for the Max Roach Clifford Brown Quintet.
Right.
If you look at Art Blakey played great drum solos,
right.
But Art Blakey is famous for leading the Jazz Messengers.
Right.
Buddy Rich played fabulous drum solos, but he's famous for leading the Buddy Rich Big Band. You see?
Got it.
So you have to understand where you fit in the music.
Right.
And a lot of cats don't understand where they fit in the music. And so you see drummer after drummer, great drummers, drummers that can play you into the ground all day and night, and they lead a band. It lasts for about a year and a half, and then they're backing up everybody because they can't sustain a band. And they can't sustain a band because they don't understand these basic principles I'm talking about. Your background. And I tell them all the time.
Wow.
You got to understand, you are part of the background.
And I don't think drummers like to hear that.
Oh, they can't stand it.
No.
They practice all day and night. They got 26 rudiments to let you know about, and they want to let you know about every one of them in every measure they play. It's a tragedy.
Oh, God.
But, you know, it's okay. I've been leading my band now. This is 27th year
as
a band leader, doing nothing but leading my band. I know great drummers that have not been able to do that.
In Rockford, and then they got into some fast. Fires, blew a mean sack. Mr. Mac Roach, beat a mean act. Mom was stopping. Suddenly in Rockford, and then the joint started jumping. Every hip spot really does want to be a town. Find a bad dude, nobody wrote, putting them down. O.B. pulled a mean string. John and Dizzy played a hip thing. Mom was something. Suddenly in Rockford, and then they got into then they got into some fast.
Why, you fool?
I mean, excitement smashed. Grown to be the mean act. Bumped up and suddenly it walked but started jumping. Every time he got to see him down, finding that nobody wrote, putting them down.
Oh, B, who's meeting straight?
And just to see played a hip thing.
Bumped up something. Suddenly it walked but I bet there was really something.
Now, I know there's, in what you're saying, that's how you're able to play with vocalists.
Yeah, of course. You need dynamics. You need sensitivity.
Right. When I said soft, it's as though you're playing with sticks, and sometimes it sounds like you're using brushes. That's how, it's like, that's how, you know, organized your playing sounds to me.
You gotta be. That's where the fun is.
Uh-huh.
That's where the actual fun is. Bashing and crashing is very athletic, but it's not a whole lot of fun because music has three elements, harmony, melody, and rhythm, and they have to fit together. And when those things are interlocked properly, as a drummer, that's what I love.
Yeah.
I love being part of the band. Most often, if someone asks me, I tell them that I lead a band. I'm a band leader, and that's not just the drummer. It's a whole different thing when you're the band leader, because band leading is not even necessarily about being the most proficient musician in the band. You know, you could make a strong case that at various points in Miles Davis' career, he was not necessarily the strongest player in the band. But what he was he was always the leader, and he was able to lead the likes of John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley and Philly Joe Jones and Red Garland, all giants, and he could lead them. They'd follow him. And you fast forward to 15, 20 years later, and he was leading another band with Wayne Shorter and Tony Williams and Ron Carter and Herbie Hancock, all giants, but Miles could lead them.
Right.
So there's something about band leading that involves diplomacy and persuasive talents and the ability to project a personality beyond the edge of the stage. All those kind of things go into band leading. And I think that a lot of young jazz musicians in general, not only drummers, they think they can simply rely on their virtuosity to carry the day. And the fact of the matter is, Thelonious Monk could not rely solely on his virtuosity. So my father had his look and a whole attitude that went along with the music that people locked in. Miles Davis had almost a weird kind of political ideology that people locked into. Coltrane and his quartet had a level of intensity that people could lock into. So there's always a little more there than simply your virtuosity on your instrument. Because quite frankly, in the world of jazz, you know what virtuosity is? It's what we call par for the course. That's all virtuosity will get you, because every jazz musician I know practices all day and night. They know their instrument inside and outside, forward and backwards, and that's just to get in the game. That don't mean you're going to play something that anybody is interested in. That don't mean you're going to play anything new. It just gets you in the game. I know a lot of drummers that got more chops than me, but a lot of them can't swing as hard as me, and they certainly can't lead no band because they're relying on their virtuosity alone, and it's simply not enough. Going back to my original statement, people do not understand drum solo. You know, it's all very simple to me. Okay?
Baby, just the two of us would be so nice. With a bump.
started playing professionally. You played with your father, and then you took a turn for the R&B and Bofi.
Yeah, but, you know, that to me is really the least explored story in modern music, because this is what actually went down. By 1975, when I finished with my father, that was really basically the low point in the history of jazz, was the mid-70s. I mean, it got so terrible that they stopped putting liner notes on the records to save a buck.
No.
You know, that was crazy. And they got over that one. I mean, if anybody loves liner notes, it's the jazz community.
Hello?
The jazz community wants to know, why'd you write that song?
We want to know who's on the song and who's playing.
Yeah, who's on the song?
Why did that come about?
Exactly.
Right.
And so it wasn't a lot of work. There was no such thing as a young lion. That didn't start until the 1980s with Wynton Marsalis. I'm part of what I call the Generation X of jazz that saved R&B music. Because if you look at the African-American groups in the 70s, whether you're talking about Consumption, Kool & the Gang, Mass Production, all of those players were actually players like myself. They were young jazz players that you would ask them, hey, man, what you doing this weekend? There was no jazz gigs. Most of the clubs were gone. So a guy would say to you, oh, I'm going to go play this Boogaloo gig.
Right.
And that's how we referred to it.
I've heard you use that term.
But what we brought along was the electric piano, the open and close hi-hat that gave us disco, which is Art Blakey's stuff, that more sensible R&B guitar fostered by the likes of Wes Montgomery, culminating in people like Cornell Dupree and George Benson. What we brought along was the harmonic sensibilities from the likes of people like Monk. I tell kids, I say, no Monk, no Parliament Funkadelic. You see? Because all them out chords and stuff and all that music and that whole harmonic attitude came from jazz.
Right.
So I did what everybody else my age was doing at that time, which was go to make a buck. And I was just one of the fortunate ones that was able to get a couple of hit records out of it.
Right.
But so that was necessity, and it was good, because without those sensibilities brought by all these young jazz musicians, you wouldn't have had a Marvin Gaye, What's Going On.
Right.
That influence culminated historically, as far as I'm concerned, with Earth, Wind & Fire, which was the absolute blend of R&B and jazz, and all the cats in that band were transplanted young jazz cats.
I mean,
Maurice White played with
Ramsey
Lewis. So I was just doing what we all did in our 20s and our 30s who were involved in jazz, because the music didn't really come back to life until Wynton Marsalis showed up. And ironically, Wynton Marsalis' success was predicated on the approval, the very vocal approval of Art Blakey. And I remember, because at the time I was involved in R&B music, but what made me give Wynton Marsalis a listen was that through the jazz grapevine, which I was still connected to, everybody said, oh man, you got to hear this kid, Wynton Marsalis. Art says he's the next one. And when somebody says Art, you know, you pay attention.
All right. Now, I object to your statement with regard to that period being a dead zone for jazz. I really object, because there were the bands that got the label of jazz fusion. They were doing rock and jazz, so to speak.
You're talking about the Frankenstein monster that they created.
No! What do you mean, Frankenstein monster?
Frankenstein actually came to life, you know, and Frankenstein was a living creature. The reason I say the Frankenstein monster is because that was forced down the throat of jazz musicians by record companies. See, I was there.
Okay.
I was in the middle of stuff. I saw that pressure on my father.
Oh, okay.
And what it was when the rock wave came, what the rock wave actually did, business-wise, was it upped the ante. Nobody had been promoted like the Beatles. Nobody was getting promoted like this new generation of rock and roll artists. And every other genre said, oh, my God, we're going to have to up the ante. Country Western did it. Gospel did it, R&B did it, everybody did it except jazz. Jazz was the only genre that said, we've got to change who we are. We're not going to spend another dime to promote. We're going to change who we are. And what we're going to do is we're going to take this rock and roll beat and put it behind this jazz tune, and then the rock and roll people will eat that up. Not. It didn't happen.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl's the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is drummer, composer, band leader, and son of pianist Thelonious Monk, T.S. Monk. What you're listening to in the background is Human from T.S. Monk's 1982 release, Human, on Raj, Funky Town Grooves Records. And T.S. Monk's on drums. Before that, we heard the hit, Bon Bon Vie, from T.S. Monk, from his House of Music release, 1980 Mirage Funky Town Grooves. And T.S. Monk is playing drums and is the lead vocalist. Before that, we heard Suddenly from T.S. Monk's Monk on Monk release. That's a 1997 N2K encoded music. T.S. Monk on drums, trumpet solo, Clark Terry, Diane Reeves on vocals, Nina Freelon also on vocals, Howard Johnson, baritone saxophone, Don Sickler on trumpet, Ronnie Matthews on piano, Willie Williams on tenor saxophone, and Gary Wang on bass. Before that, we heard Blue Monk from Ronnie Verbeest, his 2014 release on September Records, released Verbeest meets Monk, father and son. T.S. Monk on drums, Hans Van Oost on guitar, Ronnie Verbeest on accordion, baritone saxophone and harmonica, and Mario Vermandel on bass. Before that, we heard Always Know from Valenti Moya. T.S. refers to him as Valentin, and his Facebook page refers to him as Valentin. But on the release, he's Valenti Moya. Valenti Moya meets Monk. Jazz Manouche Connection. This is released this year on September Records. Valenti Moya on guitar, T.S. Monk on drums, and Marco Mezquid, M-E-Z-Q-U-I-D, on piano. And before that, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972, RCA BMG recording, originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams and more from Sugar in My Bowl right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for February 18th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's guest is drummer T.S. Monk. You can see him leading a sextet at Morrison, New Jersey's Bickford Theater on February 22nd. And this is normally the time when we go into the shows of the week, and we'll do that in a moment. But WBAI's Winter Fun Drive is going on right now, and it desperately needs your support to stay on the air and keep this show on the air. There are three ways you can give. You can call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602 while we're on the air. And we take online pledges at the website Give2. That's the number 2, WBAI.org. That's Give2, WBAI.org. Or you can simply send a text message to 41444 and enter WBAI as your message. That's a text to 41444, and WBAI is the message. You can pledge as little as $5 or consider becoming a sustaining member with a monthly pledge. And I'll repeat all that at the bottom of the segment after our music listings. We start this week with saxophonist James Brandon Lewis, who joins saxophonist Alan Lowe at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club on February 20th for a Dixieland Love Supreme. And he'll also be at Spectrum in Brooklyn on March 8th for an album release party with drummer Chad Taylor. Bassist Linda Mahon O is at Jazz at Lincoln Center with Dave Douglas on the 23rd and 24th. Vocalist Carmen Lundy is at the Jazz Standard from the 22nd through the 25th. Guitarist Bill Frizzell is at Jazz at Lincoln Center with Dave Douglas on the 23rd and 24th. Looking a little further ahead into March, vocalist Jasmia Horn is at the Jazz Standard from March 1st through 4th. Bassist Mimi Jones is at Lehman College's Performing Arts Center in the Bronx on March 3rd. Trumpeter Ibrahim Malouf is at Drom on the Lower East Side on March 3rd. Finally, pianist Mark Carey is at the Harlem Stage Gatehouse on the 9th with Mothers of the Movements, a project that remakes the Freedom Now suite with drummer Terry Lynn Carrington and bassist Reggie Workman. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can during the fund drive and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge at 516-620-3602 while we're on the air, online at give2wbai.org, or texting 41444 with WBAI as your message. The support WBAI link on the website will take you to all the details if you miss that. And again, we're always grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but have updated event listings online, and we're scheduled to be back on Sunday, March 4th, pending possible preemptions for the pledge drive. Check our website or our online feeds to keep updated. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Your mama. Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
It didn't happen, Dollar.
With regard to Miles, he didn't change who he was, and he played that type of music.
No, what Miles did was Miles moved the ball down the field. Miles' music was totally improvisational.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it was improvisations based on new rhythms.
Yes.
And new harmonics.
Yes.
And he moved the ball down the field, and fortunately, a bunch of people followed Miles.
Yes. Exactly.
But Miles was not trying to be a jazz rock artist.
No, he wasn't. He was playing his music.
Right. Because what Miles was doing, you have to understand, Miles used to come to my father's house every day.
I got it.
And the mantra for his generation and every generation of jazz musicians before Miles was do your own thing.
Exactly.
And that's why, in that period that you're talking about, let us not forget that although you enjoyed what Miles was doing, the majority of the jazz world pulled out the traitor word.
Yeah, traitor.
They called Mob a traitor.
Exactly.
A traitor.
How dare they?
Like calling George Washington a traitor for visiting Paris after the revolution.
Right.
I mean, give me a break.
Exactly.
You know? And so that's why I say Frankenstein monster. Miles was not creating a Frankenstein monster.
No.
And I watched him try to get my father to do that. Mm. And one of the reasons people love Thelonious to this day is because he didn't do it. You knew that you could rely on Monk to be Monk.
Right.
He wasn't going to change his stuff because of the new trend
right.
or the new style or none of that stuff.
Right.
You did? I understand where you disagree
yeah.
with me, but you have to look at the things in the actual perspective of what was going on at the time.
I hear you.
As far as the direction that Miles was going in, mm-hmm. which nobody else was actually going in with Jack Johnson and On the Corner and
right.
all that stuff.
Right.
I would stand next to people who we had looked at Miles as beloved for a lifetime, and then they're looking at me and saying, hey, man, I don't know what happened to Miles, man. He's a traitor to the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to say, how can Miles be a traitor?
Exactly.
He has played everything.
Exactly.
Everything that you could play. And now he's doing something new, which is exactly what I used to hear my father tell him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Take it to the next level.
That's
Take
right.
Take it somewhere new.
That's it. That's why there was music. And everyone who came through Miles's band at that time created their own version of that music
right.
that people have discounted
exactly.
between those years.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
that and that's what annoys me so.
Yeah.
That's what I object to.
I understand
what
you're
had
saying,
happened
but
and
the
what
people
they were called.
People were really silly.
I hear you. And it was also documented, unfortunately, in the series Jazz that Ken Burns provided. And that sort of just concretized that myth that there was nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's so
yeah.
untrue. Now, on the subject, though, of boogaloo music, and I guess, you know, electric, because a lot of
yeah,
the music that
sure.
was happening before was acoustic. Your drumming, using drums versus drum machines and programming. I don't know, did you program your drums when you were doing R&B?
No, I played live,
okay.
but I saw that wave coming, and I saw a lot of resistance within the drumming community to the machines. And, you know, I'm a gadget guy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were gadget people. My father used to always bring all these gadgets from Japan and all that kind of
mm-hmm.
thing. And I saw this new gadget was putting cats out of work. And I said, I can go one of two ways. I can either go like these cats and just stop, or I can learn how to play with the gadgets. So I learned how to perform with every one of those drum machines that came along with the DMX and the Lindrum
mm-hmm.
and the Dr. Rhythm. And the list goes on and on.
Right.
And I learned how to use all of them so that I could work, number one, and program. Because you have to remember, when those drum machines came out, it was notorious for, oh, who did the drums? Oh, the janitor. Oh, who did the drums? Oh, the producer. Oh, who did the drums? Oh, my girlfriend's boyfriend's best friend came in and programmed the drums. And so the machines were sounding like real machines, which
right.
turned everybody off. But the best drum machine programming was always done by real drummers. And there's a lot of great records that were made with drum machines. In fact, just to prove my point, I did a record in maybe 8-10 years ago called Higher Ground.
Yes.
And on that record, I did a composition called Cubano Chant. And Cubano Chant, the sextet plays Cubano Chant, but at least half of that tune is a drum machine, and nobody knows it to this day.
Wow.
I did it intentionally so that the critics could say, oh, Mark's using a drum machine. And I knew in my heart that they couldn't tell, because I had programmed that thing so good and integrated that thing so good with my live playing and the drum machine without a click track or anything that nobody could tell. So drum machines, I never looked at them as an enemy. In fact, let me tell you another story that's really important, goes right to this issue. In 1967, I go to Max Roach's house one day to hang out, because that's what studying with Max Roach or any one of those guys is really. You get a card that allows you to hang.
Right.
So I go to Max's house, and I walk in the door, and there's this beautiful green pearl drum kit that's on this kind of like a platform. Everything is connected to this platform, and there's wires running in and out of all these drums. Now, this was very elementary. They were basically drums with electric pickups, like a guitar pickup
mm-hmm. yes.
in each drum. And I said, wow, Max, what is that?
And he said, hey, man, this is the first electronic drum set. This is some Italian cats, and they want me to check it out. But this is where our instrument is going. So I spent the rest of the day sitting on this electronic drum kit just being a kid. And I remember the sun was going down, and I said to myself, I better get out of Max's face, because I've been banging these drums all day. Let me get the hell out of here. And so I eventually stopped playing. Max was in his room or something. And I say, hey, Max, I'm leaving now. I got to get out of here. I'll see you. And as I went towards the front door, Max Roach says, hey, too. And I turn around, and he says to me, you know what? This is really not for me. This is for the next generation. This is for you. Take them drums home with you.
Wow.
And he gave me the first electronic drum set in 1967. And right now, today, I got a $20,000 Roland electronic drum set that I own, that I use on some of my recordings. And when I look at those electronic drums, I say, Max told me this is where we were going. And we had to go through the drum machine thing, because the drum machines preceded the actual electronic drums. The problem that happened with the machines was they didn't have that human element. So the drum tracks on the records that were being made, particularly the disco records, the drums didn't breathe the way they breathed on a James Brown record or a Motown record. And that was the impetus behind the electronics industry saying, oh, man, if we make some actual electronic drum kits, the drummers will come back and play them. And that's what we have today. You see it all the time now. You see actual electronic drum kits all over the place.
The Monk Centennial continues. It was, yes, it does. 2017 was the 100th year, but the celebration continues.
Yes, it does.
In what way is it continuing?
Well, it's continuing. First of all, there's been a wonderful re-release of the Monk Coltrane at Carnegie Hall, which is the now has moved into the number two slot of all time releases for jazz, second only to Kind of Blue. I released recently a project called Liaison des Dangereuses, which was a French movie,
yes,
that had great critical acclaim. It's the only soundtrack he ever did. And we put that out earlier this year to big fanfare and wonderful, wonderful sales. I have two other extraordinary concerts that Thelonious played, one at the Hollywood Bowl in about 1964. And that's interesting because the billing of that concert on that night was Thelonious Monk and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Oh, wow.
And the crowd ate them both up.
Wow.
And just today, you would never get a promoter to book Beyonce and Wynton Marsalis.
No.
You know? But in those days, people liked a lot more variety. And so that was a wonderful concert. So I'm preparing that for Centennial release. And then a very interesting concert that he did in Palo Alto, California, around the same time, that was actually promoted by a 15-year-old high school kid who just loved Thelonious Monk. And he decided that he wanted to bring Thelonious Monk to Palo Alto, California. But at that time, Palo Alto was one of those towns that really had the proverbial railroad track, and everybody black lived on one side, and everybody white lived on the other side, and he was on the white side, but he knew all of the Monk fans were on the black side, and he was promoting it at his high school, and so he went into the black African-American community to a couple of clubs, a little Jewish kid, 15 years old, and he says, "Hey, listen, I'm bringing Thelonious Monk to my high school, and I need all you people to come out to see him."
Wow.
But it gets crazier than that, because nobody really believes him. How are you going to bring Monk to Palo Alto? So what happened was there was a very large crowd that showed up on the concert day. In those days, there was no Ticketron and none of that stuff, so people would buy their tickets right there at the concert.
Right.
And this large African-American contingent showed up in the high school playground waiting to see if Monk was going to really show up. They weren't going to buy their tickets because they didn't believe Monk was going to show up. And of course, Thelonious drove up, and the rest was history. It was a wonderful, wonderful concert. And so that's another project that I'm working on. I think it was 1964. Then I'm working on a major movie. I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary Straight No Chaser.
I most certainly did.
Okay, well, Straight No Chaser changed the whole paradigm of jazz documentaries. And today you have the wonderful Chasing Train and
yes.
the Lee Morgan documentary, the
yes.
wonderful documentary on Nina Simone and others. And Straight No Chaser really changed the dynamic for jazz documentaries. And I say no Straight No Chaser, no Ken Burns. You know, because everybody, all of a sudden, they got a chance to see this jazz musician in his environment, minus the drugs, minus all the salacious stuff, and the industry realized, oh, we can actually do a documentary without all that salacious stuff.
Right.
You know, so I'm looking with this major film that we're getting ready to work on, working on script right now with some people, and some very interesting individuals like Denzel Washington and Idris Elba are very interested in playing Thelonious,
oh,
which
yeah.
is wonderful.
I heard that.
The objective, from my perspective, right now, there is a famished, starving jazz audience waiting for the cinema to bring a film on a jazz artist to the theaters that they liked. The most recent rejection, total rejection, was the Miles Davis movie.
Thank you.
Unfortunately.
It was a rejection for me.
It was a rejection for the entire jazz community.
Okay.
And it was in what I call the spirit, going all the way back to the BS of a young man with a horn with Kirk Douglas, the Gene Krupa story,
right.
Lady Sings the Blues, Bo Better Blues. All of it has been so negative, told
right.
you nothing about these artists that we adore. Tell you nothing about where the music come from. You know, things like that. And so I figure if we can get the truth of Thelonious' life to the big screen, the minimum we'll get is every jazz lover in the world will come to the theaters to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be a lot of money because jazz is international.
That's right.
You know, but it's very, very important to me because Thelonious' actual life story is really a Horatio Alger. It's like an all-American story. For instance, people tend to say about Monk, oh, Monk was just Monk. That's what he could do. And in fact, in a famous interview, the great Bill Evans was once asked the question, well, why is Monk so different from all the rest of the jazz players and all the rest of the piano players. And Bill Evans, God bless his soul, was so wrong, it was beyond belief. But he said that the reason Monk is so different is because it's very obvious he's had no association with European classical music.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, folks, the people ate that up. It fit right into that noble savage BS that white America tends to drop on us. You know, like, white folks have to practice, and black folks don't have to practice. They just do it automatically.
It's just natural.
It's just natural. The reality is that Thelonious's first teacher was a concertmaster for the New York Philharmonic, who used to brag about the fact that he had this little black kid that was extremely proficient in playing Mozart, Chopin, Rachmaninoff. So Thelonious's roots are classical piano roots, just like Oscar Peterson and Leonard Bernstein. Thelonious was a community organizer, like our ex-president, who used to music programs in the community centers. Thelonious did fundraisers for Paul Robeson. He was in the first broadcast of the NAACP. So when you start adding all these things up, you say, wow, man, this is a guy who basically was born in a house, wasn't born in a hospital, in Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, and he ended up on the cover of Time magazine. Well, you know there's got to be a real exciting story there. And that's the story we want to bring to the stage. So we don't look to Mo Better Blues or Lady Sings the Blues or Bird as our model for this film on Thelonious. We look to Amadeus.
Okay.
We're looking to make a movie that a farmer from Iowa can go in the theater, watch this movie on Thelonious Monk, and leave saying, damn, that guy was a genius. And he was so American. I mean, if you think about Miles, just his beginnings are so unique in American history in that all these guys, my father included, basically came from down south, poor as church mice.
Not Miles.
Miles was a middle-class Negro.
Right.
Whose family were doctors and dentists and all that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Who came to New York to go to Juilliard and end up in the company of Bird and Monk and people like that.
Right.
That is a fantastic, if you tell that story, how'd that happen?
That's a story. That's a good story. That's a true story.
That's a true story. And with a lot of these guys, the truth is much, much, much better than the fiction.
Exactly.
You know, think about this. Thelonious's sister was taking piano lessons because that was the appropriate thing you did to a young girl, African-American or white in America back in the 1920s. You wanted to have culture. Got a little Emily Post thing going. You get a little dance lesson.
Right.
Piano lessons, she got a lot of culture.
Right.
So my father's sister, my Aunt Marion, she's taking piano lessons. She's like 4 or 5 years older than my father. She's struggling with these piano lessons with the piano teacher. The piano teacher goes to my grandma and says, look, Marion is a wonderful girl, but I know that these piano lessons are costing you some money. And if I were you, I think that money might be better spent on the little guy running around the house. His name is Philopolis or Philopolis, whatever. Right? And my grandma's saying, well, why? And the piano teacher told her, because every time I give Marion a lesson, mind you, my father was 4 years old at the time. Every time I give Marion a lesson, when we finish, the little guy gets on the piano and plays the lesson.
Wow.
And he don't know nothing. Now, that right there is an indicator of genius that anybody in America can understand. That's the kind of stuff that has to be in the story of Thelonious Monk. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's probably going to be a movie that probably won't be out till next year, but it's definitely going to come at you. And Thelonious is going to do what he or his name has done over and over again. He changed the face of the music itself. He changed the face of jazz documentary. I don't know if you've read Dr. Robin Kelly's book, Life
and Mind
of American
Classics. Oh, yes. I was going to bring it up. Robin D.G. Kelly's book on
okay.
Monk. Yes.
Okay. That book has changed the dynamic of jazz biography.
Yes.
And everybody says, oh, wow, man, 1,200 pages on Monk. He deserves
it. Exactly.
You know, and the Monk Institute changed the dynamic of jazz education. We're looking to do the same thing. Thelonious has been a gathering point for the light since he was a little boy. And that's what I expect to do with the movie and anything that has to do with Thelonious. Thelonious is as unique as it gets in the annals of Western music. There's nobody like him.
And that
and
is
now,
something that I wanted to bring up as well.
Also, I'm getting ready to release a couple of new things of my own that are actually takes on Thelonious's music, bringing Thelonious's music to the millennial audience. He's proved the test of time. In fact, you know, when I was about 5, 6 years old, people used to say to me, you know, your father's music is going to be more important 50 years from now than it is. So I thought these were very enthusiastic people that I'm watching people come and go every day. But here we are in 2018, and Thelonious, his name, his music, his legacy, his impact are bigger than ever. And I'm saying, damn, Daddy.
Well, you know, you are definitely a proponent of making that name continue, because I read somewhere that because of a lot of non-information that was given with regard to your father, he was presented as being a certain way, and they didn't know him, or they didn't talk to him, or they just thought
it's
stuff.
It's like the people that say that Monk didn't talk.
Right.
And I say, no,
Monk didn't talk to you
if you didn't have anything to say.
Right.
You know, but he couldn't have possibly mentored Bud Powell, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, and he didn't talk. It doesn't make any sense. Denise told me you had mentioned the word loquacious when speaking of me.
Right.
Well, let me tell you, I am a chip off the old block, an apple off the old tree. Thelonious was just as loquacious, and you ask people in my family, they will tell you, man, Uncle Thelonious start talking to me when he shut up for 3 days.
I'm grateful that you're talking about your father and keeping a truer picture of who he was alive.
I just want to add that of the Giants, there's myself and Robbie Coltrane. And no one else has anyone to protect them. Coltrane and Monk have us to protect them. You really don't have those people out there. People's estates are tied up with lawyers and management people, and they're gone. And there's nobody to make a case for them. But I know that my father was a good dad. He took me everywhere with him. He got me hip. He showed me all the right stuff. And so I feel obligated to speak for him, because by the time everybody really appreciated him, which was on the day he died, I felt obligated ever since then. Well, I'll do the talking for you, Daddy, because I know the deal, because you kept me close enough so that I know the real deal, and I'm going to tell everybody about it.
And your father transitioned in 1982, and in 1986 or 7, you co-founded and chaired the Thelonious Monk Institute.
Yeah.
So what brought that to where it is now? What was the seed that became
the seed was the fact that I knew I had watched all these different jazz societies that had been sort of muddling around for years. And I said, well, the first mistake that all these folks make are they form a society and then they go to the jazz editions for the money. When everybody knows damn well the jazz editions ain't got no money.
Right.
People who ain't in jazz know the jazz people ain't got no money. So I said, we're going to go other places, because I went to private boarding school. And when I was in private boarding school, my father was on the cover of Time magazine. And in 1964, in the day that Thelonious Monk was on Time magazine cover was reserved for the likes of Winston Churchill, Dag Hammarskjöld, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, John Kennedy. And so for this jazz musician to show up on the cover of Time magazine was outrageous. And all these rich white kids that I went to school with, their parents knew who he was, because their parents were the ones that had filled the night slots and the nightclubs as college kids. And so I said, that's where we're going. We're going to those people, and we're going to the politicians. And, you know, the first politician to pledge their support to Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz was the majority leader of the Senate at the time, Bob Dole.
Wow.
You dig? And how did we get Bob Dole? Because I told my people, I said, look, we're going to go to Bob Dole. Think about it. If I say high school to most people my age, and say Motown, they get nostalgic. They get dreamy. And everybody's got a sweet spot like that. for the music of their formative years. For Bob Dole, going to college in the 1930s and 40s, in those days, what did you do? You hired the Count Basie Orchestra, Les Brown's Band of Resound, that kind of thing. I said, we're going to go to Bob Dole, and we're not going to ask him if he supports Thelonious Monk and Charlie Parker. We're going to ask, would you support an organization that's looking to preserve the music of Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Woody Herman and all those cats? And it was the sweet spot for him, because I know that when he was wearing his diva coats in college, they were listening, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so I said, Thelonious can be a gathering point for the light. The Monk Institute was never meant to be about Thelonious. It was about what he represented. And the very first interview that I did for the Monk Institute on the night that we had our very first event, which was at Constitution Hall, which of course is the hall that wouldn't allow Marian Anderson to sing.
Right.
And after the concert, we had 29 major jazz artists. Bill Cosby hosted it. Guy, I think he was from the Washington Post, and he's a brother. And he says, can I interview you, Monk? And I say, okay, come up to my hotel room. I'm saying, oh God, isn't this wonderful? I get a chance to play some softball. It's a brother. First question out of his mouth was, so look, P.S., Washington, D.C. is Duke Ellington's town. Mm. Why is this the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz?
Oh, my.
It was as hostile a question as I could have ever dreamed of as a first question. And you know what I said to him? I didn't hesitate for 1 second. I said, let me tell you something. We all love Duke. We all love Ella. Pops is precious to us. But Thelonious is the one guy that no matter where you are in the world of jazz, when you say the name Thelonious Monk, cats practically stand up at attention and salute. And it's for that reason that Thelonious is a gathering point for the light, and everybody will respond to the ideology that he represents. It's universal in all quarters of jazz, the in cats, the out cats, the Stacy Dudes, the smooth jazz. So everybody agrees that Monk, oh yeah, we can operate in his name. And that was the seed that made the Monk Institute possible.
We'll be right back.
And if you look at our history over the past 30 years, you'll see that we've involved everybody from the likes of Clint Eastwood to K.D. Lang, Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder. We don't, the divided house of jazz, and I have to rationalize my thinking to my people. I say things to them like, you know, when I talk to this punk rocker and this hard rocker and this new age rocker, and I ask them, what kind of musician are you? They say, I'm a rock and roller, period. And I said, when you talk to the country people, people in Memphis, bluegrass cats out in the countryside, they say, I'm a country player. But when you start asking jazz musicians, oh, well, I'm a straight-ahead jazz player. Oh, I play classic jazz. Oh, I play smooth jazz. We're not getting into the divided house of jazz here at the Monk Institute. Everybody's in because that's what I was taught, that everybody has got something to say. Everybody can contribute. And I watched my father come in the house one night, railing on about Ornette Coleman. But you know what he was saying? He was saying, you know, man, Ornette's playing the trumpet with the saxophone mouthpiece. He needs to make a decision. But he never for once said that what Ornette was doing was not part of the music.
Nice.
And so I realized that people on Thelonious's level did not divide the music up the way the media and the pundits were doing it, and we're not going to do it at the Monk Institute. Everybody is in. And once people realized that everybody was in, everybody came. And that's what's made the Monk Institute a success over the years, because it's all in. Every kind of jazz is all jazz. If you're operating with the basic principles of individuality, communication, teamwork, tolerance, then you're a jazz player, and that's why I'm proud to say, and I know it for a fact as a result of our International Jazz Day, that jazz is the only music that is played in every single country of the civilized world.
Very true.
Because jazz goes to the basic, fundamental humanity of mankind. Everybody understands freedom of thought, individuality. I need to know you. And those principles make jazz appealing to everybody in the world. Everybody can understand jazz. And all of those things that I've just spoken about are the things that have contributed to the success of the Monk Institute.
One of our more recent programs, we spoke to one of the winners of the vocal competition, Jasmia Horn, who was also nominated for a Grammy. She is amazing. We love her.
Yeah.
And there are so many people who have come through those competitions.
Well, I'm proud to say, and I can say it with total confidence, that the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz has put more major new artists in the marketplace over the past 30 years than any major jazz label. Nobody's done it like we've done it. You know, whether you're talking about Joshua Redman, Marcus Roberts, Jane Monheit, Cecile, Roberta Gamberini, the list just goes on and on of artists that have had commercial success as a result, because I always said, and we all agreed at the Institute, that it doesn't stop when you win the competition. And so first thing we would always say to a winner once they won was, look, there's going to be a lot of people coming at you. You need some help. You need to know who's actually can do something for you and who's full of you know what. We're going to be right behind you to make sure that you have a successful career. So that's another reason why the Monk Institute has been so successful.
Wow.
It's because young artists know that associating with the Institute is going to be more than just like graduating from Juilliard and then, you know, you just a Juilliard alumni.
Right.
Juilliard don't really do nothing to move you.
Right. You're on your own.
Yeah, you're on your own. We've never believed that at the Monk Institute. So I'm very, very proud of the work we've done. I got a big mouth, and so I wasn't afraid in the early years to make it very clear that I thought the jazz education was abysmal, because when I look to the classical world, if I look to Eastman School of Music or Juilliard, they got the finest classical players on the planet teaching. But I go to these jazz programs, and they've got some guy that has been teaching Mozart and Brahms for the past 30 years of his life, and they just said, oh, now you're going to teach jazz. So you had kids coming out of jazz programs that couldn't play. And I said, they can't play because you don't have jazz musicians teaching them how to play. I was with Clark Cherry one time. He said he was doing a clinic, and he was about to play the blues, and he picked a rather odd key, and one of the kids in the class jumped up, who had been studying at the school, and said, Mr. Terry, we can't play it in that key because blues is in B flat.
Oh, my.
You see, it's because the Eurocentric concept is to formalize things.
Right.
And jazz is not built on formulas like that. Robert Johnson didn't know a damn thing about a B-flat scale.
No.
You know what I'm saying? So we were very vocal. And I can tell you, at the time we started the Monk Institute in 1987, you had David Baker and you had Nathan Davis in Pennsylvania. You had Jackie McLean
yes.
up in New Haven, and you had Album Batiste down in New Orleans, and those were the only known credible entities that were heading jazz departments around the country. And everywhere else, you had all these transplanted Eurocentric European classical artists trying to teach jazz. And if you look around today, there's actually major universities with tenured seats for major jazz artists to head their jazz department. And all of a sudden, great players are beginning to come out of the schools. This issue of jazz education has been a major point of contention for me. Take myself, for instance. In the academic world, up until recently, because now they also want to give honorary degrees to anybody they can to get them associated with their universities. But years ago, if someone said to me, I was a violinist, and they said, wow, where did you go to school? And if I would have said, well, actually, I spent a year and a half with Yasha Heifetz, and then I spent another 6 months with Yitzhak Perlman, and then I hung out with Leonard Bernstein, they wouldn't give a damn about the school. The credibility inherent in that would be enough. So when people today ask me, well, did you go to music school? I say, no, but I studied with Max Roach and hung out with Art Blakey and knew Roy Haynes and da-da-dee-da-da-da-da. And now people are beginning to understand that that's in many ways even more substantial than going to music school.
Definitely.
So the whole dynamic of jazz education has changed, and I would attribute that change to two organizations, primarily the Monk Institute and Winton with Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Okay, I was thinking Berkeley.
Let me tell you about Berkeley. The president of Berkeley School of Music once told the director of the Monk Institute in a very candid moment, because we've done a number of things with Berkeley School of Music, you know, we're fully aware that we are like the premier jazz institution in the country, but you guys at the Monk Institute, you guys are like Oxford.
Okay.
And people go from Harvard to Oxford to learn more. So the respect that the Monk Institute has garnered by all the major jazz education institutions has been fantastic, and I attribute that not to myself, not to the staff of the Monk Institute, but to the thousands of jazz artists that have donated their time in high schools, elementary schools, and universities all around the world. That's why we've been successful at the Monk Institute, because it's rank and file driven.
I actually wasn't aware that the International Jazz Day came out of the Monk Institute.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, Donald Trump just cut all the funding to UNESCO, but that was a project between the Monk Institute
and UNESCO.
Yeah. But of course, you know, UNESCO had no jazz credentials, so they needed somebody to put it together, and it's a tribute to Herbie Hancock, whose idea it was. We worked at the Institute along with others, but we did a lot because we had a close association with Bill Clinton and George Bush and Obama, and we worked for many years to get Herbie to be designated as the first jazz ambassador since Dizzy Gillespie back in the 1960s, official U.S. ambassador.
So you're basically saying that as a result of the cutting from UNESCO, that there won't be an international jazz day?
There very well may not be one, because we've done it at the White House, but we've also done it in Osaka, Japan, in Istanbul, and we've done it in Paris. And so it costs a lot of money to fly in artists from all over the world and put the whole show together. So it's been very, very successful, but I don't know. It depends on budgets and those kinds of things.
Now,
but if we don't, we'll be doing something else.
Okay. One last question for you. It's not so much a question, it's more to hear your thoughts of the state of the music today.
I think that right now, I think all of the genres are going through a bit of turmoil because the medium is changing. You know, we're shifting from CDs to streaming. So that requires a different kind of preparation and a different format for the music. And I think that's affecting everybody. I think what has happened with jazz is that it has taken its place in the great pantheon of genres, but it's going to be there forever. It has a half-life far greater than most. I mean, we have something in the music industry today called catalog.
Yes.
Well, catalog is a creation of jazz. There was no such thing as catalog before jazz. Catalog came about when some executive looked at their books in 1975 and said, you know, this Charlie Parker record that we put out in 1955 is selling more records today than it was then. Maybe we need to reissue all this stuff.
Right.
And so they started reissuing and reissuing, and you don't hear nobody reissuing the Delphonic.
No,
you know?
Really, no.
You don't hear about no new release of Confunction.
As good as they were, but no one's reissuing that.
I think jazz is rather unique. I think when I look at the new artists, they're very successful, they're very popular, and I just think jazz is never going to go anywhere because from an artistic and purely artistic perspective, jazz is then what I call the unwilling amputee for all the other genres because people are constantly snatching stuff out of jazz, the harmonics, or it's the rhythms, or it's the ensemble configuration, or whatever it is. The other genres, they get bogged down because they're so driven by commerciality, they get trapped in sort of a loop, and when they need something new, they snatch something out of jazz, and it turns their whole genres around. And it's happened over and over again. So I think, unlike the other genres, I think jazz is unique to the United States, unique to the world of music, and will be here forever. And I always say that although jazz initially the product of African Americans, I think the key operative word there is American. That's why it wasn't invented in Africa, because jazz reflects this unique confluence of spirituality and technology and politics and all those things that make America what it is. So I tell young students, I say, if somebody asks you, what is jazz? I tell them the answer is jazz is America.
Okay, that is true. And on that note.
Okay, my dear.
Thank you so much, T.S. Monk.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It has been wonderful talking to you as well.
Being Thelonious Monk's son, I will have to say, has been a magic carpet ride for me from the day I was born right up until talking to you. I've had a good time. That silly little record that I made in 1980, Bum Bum Beat, plays all over the country. It's like one of the national anthems of all the DJs. Every
and I
DJ,
was just going to say, it's been sampled.
And it's been sampled by everybody and their mother. And I toured the country with the likes of Slade, Sister Sledge, Kool & the Gang, Sky, Clear, all those groups, and Lakeside, and everybody, and most of their records get pulled out now and then. Bon Bon V gets pulled out every day all over the country, and even here in New York, Michael Basin used the introduction of Bon Bon V for the introduction to his radio show for 5 years.
Excellent.
I have been blessed. I've been on the cover of Downbeat twice, and my father was never on the cover of Downbeat in his whole career until he died.
Wow.
I'm a drummer that had the jazz CD of the year. I mean, I've had a good time. I ain't got no complaints, darling.
And there's more to come, and we've had a good time with you.
I definitely ain't finished. Okay.
Thank you so much, T.S. Monk.
You take good care.
You do the same.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is Ugly Beauty from T.S. Monk. That's from his 1997 Monk on Monk release on N2K Encoded Music. T.S. Monk on drums, Jerry Allen on piano, Howard Johnson on baritone saxophone, Gary Wang on bass, Willie Williams on soprano saxophone, Roger Rosenberg on tenor saxophone, Eddie Burt on trombone, Wallace Roney, trumpet soloist, Don Sickler on trumpet, and Virgil Jones on trumpet. Before that, we heard Little Rudy Tootie, also from the Monk on Monk release, T.S. Monk on drums, Bobby Percelli on alto saxophone, Howard Johnson on baritone saxophone, Ron Carter on bass, Roy Hargrove on flugelhorn, Danilo Perez on piano, Rover Washington Jr., tenor saxophone soloist, Willie Williams on tenor saxophone, Roger Rosenberg on tenor saxophone, Eddie Burt on trombone, Don Sickler on trumpet, and Virgil Jones on trumpet as well. Before that, we heard Well You Needn't from Valenti Moya's Valenti Moya Meets Monk, Jazz Manouche Connection. It was released this year on September Records. Valenti Moya on guitar, T.S. Monk on drums, Marco Mesqued on piano. Before that, we heard Evidence from Ron Carter, T.S. Monk. This is from a compilation, Bob Belden's Shades of Blue, 1996 compilation on Blue Note Records. T.S. Monk on drums and Ron Carter on bass. And show your financial support to WBAI by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Or you can text us. Text the number 41444 and text WBAI. That's 41444 and text WBAI. La Nueva Alternativa coming up next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.